And we return. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Bonnie, how about a slice of key lime pie with a dollop of fresh whipped cream? That sounds pretty
good. Is it
good.
Natural is the question.
Well, today we examine a movement that has burgeoned in recent years and decades. The natural food phenomenon. Whole Foods, Fresh Market, Trader Joe's, and others are immensely profitable. Joining us now is historian and former natural foods marketer Joe Dobrow. He's written Natural Profits, From Health Foods to Whole Foods, How Pioneers of the Industry Changed the Way We Eat and Reshaped American Business. Bonnie, have you noticed that the book titles, the subtitles are getting longer and longer and longer?
It's almost a first question.
So your first question.
Yes. Hi, Joe. Nice to have you with us.
Good morning, Bonnie and Joseph. It's a pleasure and an honor to be with you. And Joseph, I wanted to congratulate you on your 40th anniversary at the station. I thought that was a great article.
Oh, you've been parading around on our website, I guess.
I did. You know, that photo of you, that vintage photo, makes it look like you might actually have shopped in some of those health food stores back in the day.
I was thinking we had the Oak Feed Store here in Miami back then. We had the Spiral Restaurant.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Here Comes the Sun was there for a while.
I had a roommate in college who drove us all crazy because he was into that macrobiotic and the brown rice all the time.
Well, let's talk to Joe. Joe, it's remarkable when one thinks that a handful of these idealistic people, and they were thought of as hippies, freaks, food nuts, all sorts of things I remember, actually changed the way we eat. So take us back to the beginning, which was really the 60s. How did it look at that time?
It's been an amazing transformation, and it's happened very, very rapidly, too, which is really all the more remarkable. So if you go back to our grandparents' day, or maybe our great-grandparents, all of the food that they ate was natural and organic. Now, we didn't call it that. We didn't have those labels back then, but you know, pretty much everything that they ate came straight from nature with minimal processing. And as I have said in the book, you know, there were no chemicals in the equation because there was no equation. And it all changed very, very quickly right after World War II. In the space of maybe 15 years, we went from this world that was all authentic and natural and organic to a world that was almost all synthetic because there were so many new chemical compounds that came into being. So as you said, Bonnie, it was during the 1960s that we began to swing that pendulum back in the other direction just a notch. And it was because this generation of people that had been born in the early years of the baby boom, they were the flower children of the 60s. They grew up rejecting everything around them, government, big business, synthetic food, Wonder Bread, you name it. They came of age during that time, and they looked around and they decided that it was up to them to try to save the world. And their way of doing that was initially through food. So in the book, in Natural Profits, I go back and recount the stories of many of these entrepreneurs who grew up during this time period, and they started companies like Celestial Seasonings Tea and Stonyfield Farm Yogurt, and Whole Foods Market, and so it happened both on the manufacturing and on the retail side, and it was the power of their ideas that really made the difference.
Well, remind us, though, what the people were thought of that frequented those stores. You know, I mean,
oh, gosh, yeah.
They were really marginal, thought of as marginal and a little bit, you know, out there.
A lot out there, yeah. I mean, there's a great quotation that I came up with from Life magazine. This was in 1962, and this really gives you a sense for the way that people thought about the progress that was being made. And they wrote, "The U.S. farmer now approaches a mastery over nature. He alters nature almost at will, breeding his animals and plants to consumer preference, growing gardens where climate and soil had all but outlawed life, changing the very chemistry of the earth to feed the ravenous roots of his bumper crops." Well, that was the march of progress. That was the way that many people felt during that era. So imagine along come these people like Mo Siegel, who was the founder of Celestial Seasonings Tea, and they've got shaggy hair, they've dropped out of college, they are touting the benefits of brown rice or of herbal tea or of the macrobiotic diet or turbinado sugar or these things that were so far outside the mainstream that, of course, the people who were shopping at the Winn-Dixies and the Piggly Wigglies of the world at that point weren't going to go near that stuff. And they did ridicule the so-called health nuts and these food faddists. And they really felt that this was just another subversive element of the 1960s, and it really was not a serious business at all.
Give us a short history thumbnail about going back to the early days around the turn of the century with the Kellogg's and the Posts and that whole movement for cereals.
Yeah, I talk about this quite a bit in Natural Profits. In the late 19th century, the Battle Creek Sanitarium and the Kellogg Company really were one of the centers for the health movement in the United States. And so there were several cereal companies that grew up out of that. And one of them was the what we now call Post. It was then called the Postum Cereal Company. And they had breakfast beverages. They had a cereal that they called Elijah's Manna, which was prudently changed a few years later to Post Toasties, and Grape Nut cereal and things like that. And, of course, these were made with natural ingredients because, again, we didn't have the preservatives and the emulsifiers and the sweeteners and the coloring agents and things like that back then. But they went even further, and they made all sorts of outrageous health claims for what these cereals could do for you. So, again, there was no FDA there to be overseeing these sorts of claims, and it was really left up to the consumer to sift through what was snake oil salesman pitch and what was true. But those, the foundations of those companies really became the big agriculture and big food companies that we are used to today. So Post eventually became General Foods, and throughout much of the 20th century, and of course still to this day, they are one of the major manufacturers out there, and they're, I would say, largely about profits, but they were originators of many of the famous brands of the 20th century, many of which had all sorts of artificial ingredients in them. And it's only in these last few years, with the success of the natural foods movement, that the big food guys have finally started to turn their attention to it, roll out some natural versions of their own. And you can even look at something like Fruity Pebbles, of all things. And now there's a gluten-free version of it. So without necessarily preaching that everybody should go and switch to an all-natural and organic diet, I think that's a matter of personal choice. I nevertheless think that it's a great accomplishment that the natural foods industry has been so successful and has come so far and has influenced those big food companies like General Foods.
Well, let's look at some of those early pioneers or prophets, as you call them. It's a very nice double entendre that you have for the name of your book, because they do make such big profits these days. But let's begin with Mo Siegel. You credit him with building the first major natural foods business and cracking the code. What did he do right?
Mo was a remarkable guy. So he started to go to college, decided it wasn't for him, moved up into the mountains of Colorado, and was selling posters at a tiny little health food store up there called Mother's Natural Foods. But during his free time, he would go out and hike, and he started picking a lot of wild herbs and brewing tea with them, and he found that the tea was really good. In fact, Mo said that one of his greatest skills was for picking herbs that actually would sell. So he thought perhaps there was a real business in this, and he moved to Boulder. And in 1969, he created this company called Celestial Seasoning. So think back to what life was like in tea and coffee world at that point. There was no herbal tea in the U.S. It was somewhat popular in Europe. But here, we just had the traditional black teas.
Lipton.
The Liptons, the Tetleys, things like that.
Right.
And so Mo was creating something that was very different from that. And it was rough slogging there for a while. He had no money. He had no access to capital. He had no blueprint for how you would create a company like this. And so initially, he went down to the bank, just like anybody would do, and he gave them a business plan. And he said someday he thought this could be $100 million company, this herbal tea company, and he just needed a $25,000 loan to get started. And so he's in the office of the bank manager, and it's this glass enclosed office. And in the middle of the meeting, the manager interrupts Mo and his partner and asks whether he can bring in his other partners from the bank so that they can hear the pitch as well. And so they come in, these guys in their three-piece suits, and Mo continues with his story. And at the end of it, he thinks everything's gone very well. He leaves, they shake hands, and as he's walking out of the bank, he looks back at this glass office and he sees all of these bankers in there doubled over in laughter. Mm. Because they thought this was the most ridiculous thing that they'd ever heard, an herbal tea business that was going to be a $100 million one. But, of course, Mo ended up getting the last laugh, because by hook or by crook, he built Celestial into a very important company. They became, as you said, really the very first big natural foods company. And they now are known as Hain Celestial. With merger with Hain Foods that happened a few years ago, and they are the largest manufacturer of natural organic foods in the world.
Mm. Isn't that really a great story? We're speaking with Joe Dobrow, and his book is entitled Natural Profits from Health Foods to Whole Foods on today's topical currents. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back and ask for your calls and your comments on topical currents.
And we're back. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Joe Dobrow. We're talking about his book, Natural Profits. If you'd like to join in, that's easy enough. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email. That's radio at WLRN.org and Twitter.
Twitter, excuse me, is at Topical Currents. And I just want to add, because I said there was a double entendre with the name of the book, but I didn't spell it because the name of it is Natural, P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Just to clarify.
Tell me, Joe, is there a parallel to the burgeoning modern natural foods movement? A parallel to, say, what happened in Seattle and Silicon Valley with the digital boom?
Yeah, I do think so. In fact, the way that I look at it, I think the entrepreneurs of the natural foods movement have really been more important contributors to the well-being of the planet than the entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley. Usually, when we're handing out praise for the great entrepreneurs of our era, the list starts with Bill Gates and it ends with Steve Jobs. And certainly they have impacted all of our lives in an amazing way. But you look at the natural foods industry, they had no access to money. They had no easy way to go about doing this. And what they've ended up accomplishing has not only created products that, like the tech industry, exist in all of our homes. I would venture to say that virtually every one of your listeners, if they opened up their refrigerator or looked in their pantry at this moment, would see that USDA organic seal staring back out at them, or find some of the other major natural foods brands, including, by the way, some of the ones that are Florida-based, like Lucini Italia, which is right there in the Miami area, or Back to Nature or Florida Crystals. All, you know, good, sound natural foods companies that are Florida-based companies. But in addition to that, the thing that makes the natural foods entrepreneurs so special is that they really have influenced many other industries besides food and food retailing. Because now we live in a world in which most companies are at least partially mission-based, mission-driven, and it's impossible to think of a company starting up here in the 21st century and not hewing to this philosophy of the so-called triple bottom line, where the old bottom line of just profits is balanced by a focus on the environment and on people as well. So the triple bottom line. That's one of the real great legacies of the natural foods industry.
And, are the people working at Trader Joe's really as happy as they appear to be and so bushy-tailed? And I suppose they treat their employees pretty well.
I think so. That's one of the few retailers out there that I haven't worked for, because I was the head of marketing for Whole Foods and Freshfields before that, and more recently for Sprouts Farmers Market. But I will say this, because I think it's an important point, that the people who do work in retailing in this industry are different than people who work at other retail outlets. You know, we've unfortunately come to accept a great deal of mediocrity in customer service and in the knowledge levels of people who work in retail. And one of the great things about natural organic foods is that the people behind it are incredibly passionate. And this goes, in many cases, most cases, I would say, right down to the people who are cashiers in the stores at places like a Trader Joe's or a Whole Foods, because they believe in a mission that's larger than just making money.
It was sort of a Ben and Jerry's attitude.
Yeah, and Ben and Jerry's was, in fact, one of the, you know, the early leaders in this industry as well. There's this mission focus that so many people in the industry have shared.
I hadn't planned on jumping ahead like this, but since we're talking about Trader Joe's now, and we're talking a little bit about Whole Foods, this is something, you know, I wanted to ask you later, but why are the prices at Whole Foods so high while at Trader Joe's the prices are so reasonable, and they pride themselves on that, and they both pride themselves on natural and organic foods? Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think it's a fair question. Look at the two different business models. Trader Joe's, I would estimate 60 to 80% of the grocery items in there are their own private label. And when you are creating your own private label, you are in full control of what margin you want to make on it. And Trader Joe's does a fantastic job of procuring items from around the world. They do lots of closeout specials. You might find something in there today and absolutely fall in love with it, and then 3 weeks from now, it's gone and you might never see it again.
Right.
That happened to me recently with their dried apple slices. They have these bagged apple slices from New Zealand that are fantastic, and I became completely addicted to them, and then they were gone. I think they're back now, but that's part of the Trader Joe's model, and it's one of the reasons, in addition to just their overall corporate philosophy, where they build stores inexpensively and much smaller stores.
Right.
I've learned the hard way not to go to Whole Foods hungry, or else you wind up with a hellacious bill.
Well, let's talk about the prices since we are now. Why are they so high when, you know, some people would say, well, if everything's so natural, why should it be higher than things that have all these additives? Wouldn't they cost more?
Right. Doesn't that, you know, when I was running marketing for companies like that, that was one of the ads that I would often say is, you look at this list of ingredients on a conventional food item, and there's so many more things in there. Wouldn't you think that would be more expensive rather than less expensive? But the reality is you really have to kind of work your way back up the food chain. And so when you think about the companies that are manufacturing the natural and organic foods, first of all, they don't have a lot of these cheap fillers out there. If, for example, they want to sweeten their product, they're not going to use high fructose corn syrup, and they're certainly not going to use aspartame or any of the artificial sweeteners that are very inexpensive because they're really just chemicals. They are going to use pure cane sugar, or they are going to use agave, or perhaps they're going to use the botanical natural sweetener stevia. And these things are not mass produced. They are a much smaller batch. They're getting there. I mean, they're getting more popular and they're more accessible, but all of the raw ingredients costs are more expensive for these manufacturers. And the overall manufacturing is happening in much smaller lots. So I mentioned Luchini and Back to Nature before. Luchini is not Wesson. Luchini imports fantastic high-quality olive oils, but in very, very small quantities. And so, like any commoditized industry, you have to get to scale in order to bring the costs down. Now, the good news is this, and as somebody who's been eating natural foods for a long time and has been working in the industry for 20 years, I do think we're getting there. I really think that the cost of natural foods have come down significantly, and of organics, and that if you are prudent about the way that you go about your shopping and you pay attention to some of the deals out there, or you look at that 365 line at Whole Foods, or you buy some things at Trader Joe's, it is possible to eat a natural and organic diet at a minimal cost difference. Now, Joseph, you made the point. You go into Whole Foods and it's dangerous because you get tempted by
ready to eat stuff. Yeah.
Oh yeah, and that's exactly right. One of the brilliant things that Whole Foods has done is to build up that prepared foods department, and they do some great things there. But they then suffer from this halo effect. You know, people come in and they see these outrageously priced artisan loaves of bread or a jar of apple butter or something from the prepared foods department. And the assumption that they make then is that everything in the store is similarly outrageous and high. And really, when you dig into it, it's not as bad as all that.
How about Walmart going into the natural foods area and organics so that lower income people would have access to natural foods? Is that still going on?
Well, supermarkets are doing that now.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, both. Walmart is the largest retailer of organic milk in the world. They're the largest retailer of organic cotton products. And they clearly have had an influence on that. And, you walk up and down the aisles of a Walmart or a Target today, and you will see lots of these brands that used to be just the domain of the small natural food stores in larger pack sizes. And you know, that's been very important for growing the industry. Because the reality is that even with all of the great progress that we've made with the Celestial Seasonings and the Stonyfield Farms and the Honest Teas and the Whole Foods, that still, of every $100 spent on food in the United States, only $5 to $6 is natural and organic. So we need, dare I say, the Walmarts and the Targets and the Publix and the Winn-Dixies of the world to be able to reach the 95 out of 100 customers who are not shopping in the natural food stores.
And can those labels be trusted? I mean, they have to comply with the same standards for organic that Whole Foods does, for example, right?
Absolutely. But let's be careful about the distinction there. So with organic, yes, we have a national organic law that was passed in 1990. It fully went into effect in 2002. Prior to that, each state had its own organic standards, and so you could go into a store and see something called Colorado Organic or Pennsylvania Organic, and they were different. But nowadays, that USDA organic seal is your confidence that this was produced in the way that has been set forth by the federal government with a lot of input from the industry. And it doesn't matter where you buy it as long as it's got that seal on it. Things that are marked natural or all natural.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah, well, in one sense, it means nothing.
Right.
Because there is no federal standard for it and there are no state laws behind it. But in another sense, and I hope that you and your listeners would find this reassuring, within the industry, there is a consensus on what all natural means and has been for a long time. And generally, it means something that is minimally processed with no artificial flavors, preservatives, or other additives in it.
You mean like Hot Pockets?
Exactly. So, you know, you have to be cautious. I would certainly say that when you see something that is called all natural, because there's enough wiggle room there that if somebody has untoward intentions and they want to be able to kind of couch a questionable product in that, there's no legal way to prevent them from doing that yet. I do think that the industry is moving toward that, and perhaps the government will move toward that as well.
You'd think that with all the popularity of the natural food movement today, and as we're saying, in Target, Walmart, and supermarkets, you know, mainstream supermarkets, we still hear that obesity and heart disease are epidemics in our society. So why do you think that is?
Well, again, I think we've only really scratched the surface now in terms of natural and organic. And honestly, even there, natural and organic doesn't necessarily mean it's low fat. When I was at Fresh Fields and at Whole Foods, we always used to tell people that, yes, we carry brownies, but given that you're going to eat a brownie, wouldn't it be better to eat one that's got all natural ingredients than doesn't? So it's not a matter of preaching to the consumer and saying this is healthy or this is going to keep your weight down. That's still up to all of us, I think, to monitor our diets and our exercise levels and make sure that we're doing right by ourselves. But still, again, I come back to that statistic that it's just a handful of the dollars that are being spent on food are being spent on natural and organic.
Yeah.
And that's true whether it's at retail or in restaurants. You know, in the book, I talk a little bit about Terry Dalton, who is a Florida native, or has lived in Florida for many years. And Terry created restaurants that people down there would be familiar with. The original one was called Chestnut that he opened in Fort Lauderdale in the late 70s. But he was the one who created Unicorn Village.
Oh, what was his name?
Terry Dalton.
Terry Dalton.
Yeah, and he was an old natural foods guy. He had run this tiny little natural food store out in Oregon and had been deeply affected by all the stories about DDT that came out after Silent Spring was published in 1962. But yeah, Terry opened Unicorn Village in North Miami Beach in 1979 and moved it to Aventura about 10, 11 years later. And it continues to really be a beacon for people in the vegan and the natural foods movements. And he was the one who called to my attention that there's now this movement that's really beginning to take hold across the country with fast, casual, natural or vegan restaurants. One of which, Life Kitchen, was actually created by a former top executive at McDonald's. So that to me again is sort of a good news indicator that says that yeah, the problems of obesity and America's declining health have to be addressed on all fronts. Natural and organic foods will certainly help. Natural and organic restaurants will help as well.
If you want to join in the conversation, we're speaking with Joe Dobrow. He was head of marketing for Fresh Fields and Whole Foods Market and Balducci's, among others. And his book is entitled Natural Profits. Do you buy natural or organic? Do you trust the labels? Do you have memories of early health food stores? If you want to join in, the number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org.
And let's take a call. First up, it's Don. He's in Plantation. Hi there.
Hello, Bonnie and Joe. I haven't called in quite a while.
Hi.
I think this topic is something I can't resist calling in about. I am one of those anti-establishment baby boomer refugees from the 1960s who went whole hog, no pun intended, into the natural food thinking and with brown rice and fresh fruits and vegetables and frequented places like Mama Mango's and Oak Feed, and Here Comes the Sun.
Do you remember Granny Feel Goods?
And Granny Feel Goods, of course. You know, we can go on with all these names that spark so many memories. But one thing I have issue with today that I wanted to bring up was the idea of what's available in organic foods at the typical establishments today, like Whole Foods, which I frequent. And it has to do with, for instance, organic fruit, let's say, and comparing it to non-organic. When you go and grab a organic peach, for instance, out of the supermarket, and compare it to a non-organic peach, there really isn't very much difference. And I think the reason is, and you can say that about apples or you know whatever, is that the organic is picked too early, unripe, just like the non-organic, and shipped that way for business reasons. And so the nutritional value is compromised. And if you compare the two in terms of nutrition, which is done in a lot of testing, it, of course, comes out to be very similar. And then the mass market food industry jumps on that to exploit ignorance and say, you know, see, organic really isn't any advantage.
Joe, can you verify that or comment on it? Or?
Yeah, I think Don is right in most regards there. There's nobody, almost nobody in the organic industry that would claim that there's a nutritional difference between a conventionally grown piece of fruit and an organically grown one. And there may not be a taste difference, although those of us like Don and me who have been eating this way for a long time probably would argue that point. But there are externalized costs, and those have to be taken into account, because when you buy organic, you are supporting generally smaller family farms. You are reducing the amount of pesticides and herbicides that are being used in the environment. You know that you are buying something that is not raised with any genetically modified ingredients in it, because that is part of the organic law. And so all of those things make this a better, smarter purchase, at least as far as that triple bottom line is concerned. The cost may be a little higher. The nutritional difference may be negligible, but there are many, many other benefits to it.
You mentioned in passing a Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, but it was revolutionary at the time, and it affected the use of chemicals and pesticides and the whole natural food movement. Tell us about that.
DDT had been developed mostly during World War II by the military, and it was very effective in helping to rid troops of malaria and other things like that. And then it was released to the public in 1945, and it quickly became the most popular pesticide out there. In fact, they boasted that a 60-day-old application of DDT on a barn door would still kill any fly that happened to land on it. Mm. That's how potent it was. The problem was that Mother Nature had a little trick up her sleeve called evolution. And because there are so many generations of insects born in a single year, they can quickly build up immunities to pesticides. And they did to DDT. And within just 4 years of DDT's release to the public, in 1949, more than 80% of all flies were immune to it already. So DDT continued to roll out, but it was being countered by evolutionary forces. And so when Rachel Carson came out with Silent Spring in 1962, she documented a lot of this and talked about some of the effects of people who had been exposed to DDT in animals and ecosystems, and it was devastating. And she wrote in such beautiful and poetic but still graphic language that it had an enormous psychological impact on those who read it. And generated a very stiff response from the agricultural industry as well, which rejected a lot of her claims. Well, DDT was eventually banned. It took many years. I think it wasn't until 1972 that it ended up getting banned. But that was one of those seminal moments that really turned the tide in the industry and began for the very first time to help the American public see some of the risks that were inherent with this new chemical agriculture that we had invented after World War II.
And let's go back to our callers. This is Melissa. She's in Pembroke Pines. Hi.
Hello. Good afternoon. So I have a question about the book that I would really like to pick this up, but I wanted to know if you touch on the African-American influence in the natural foods market, such as Dick Gregory or Queen of Fua, Soul Vegetarian, like that?
Interesting question, and I have to say that I did not. When I looked at the industry as a whole, there are so many different stories to go down. And, for example, one of the areas that I don't think I did a good enough job on as well were some of the women entrepreneurs. There are a few of them in there, but really not enough. So, no, I mean, Dick Gregory as an activist and eloquent spokesperson, I think, would be a terrific person to include in this book as well. I agree.
Well, thank you. I look forward to picking this up.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Joe Dobra, the publisher of the book is Rodale, which has had a long-time organic advocacy stance in its publications. But there also was some controversy about Rodale. Can you take us through that just a little bit?
Yeah. The Rodale family got involved in organic agriculture very early on. J.I. Rodale was the patriarch of the family, and he started a farm near Allentown, Pennsylvania, in mid-20th century, and became very interested in the notion of organics, and began testing side by side in patches of land, organic and conventional agriculture. And he launched Organic Farming and Gardening magazine and later Prevention magazine, and really became a strong advocate for it. But he was also viewed as a kook, because there were a lot of quirky things about him and his personality. And there's a really remarkable story about him that in 1971, he'd been pegging away at this now for many years. In fact, had mostly handed off the company to his son, Bob, at this point. But finally, he was given his moment in the sun. And the New York Times wrote a lengthy feature article about him on, I believe it was June 6th, 1971. And they talked about all that he had done and all that he had believed in and how he did some strange things, like he would, he took like 70 supplements a day, which nowadays not too many people would bat an eyelash at, but back then it was very unusual. Mm-hmm. And he invented a device that he would sit in for a few minutes each day that would generate electrical currents, electromagnetic currents, because he had come to believe that with the steel girders and buildings and the concrete floors that we were being robbed of the natural electrical currents that had always coursed through the planet. So there was some sort of oddball stuff like that. But out comes this huge article in the New York Times Sunday magazine, and then 2 days later, J.I. Rodale goes on to the Dick Cavett Show, which of course was one of the big talk shows at the time. And while they're sitting on the couch and before the show starts, J.I. says, "I've never felt better in my life, and I've decided I'm going to live to be 100. He was 72 years old at the time, and moments later, he suffered a heart attack and died.
Mm. On now, the show?
Well, they never aired that episode.
Well, yeah, obviously.
Imagine. But yeah, he was just right there on the set. And so, I mean, it was a shocking thing to the family and to the industry. And as I say, Bob Rodale at that point had pretty much taken over the reins. And Rodale today, of course, is a big and fantastic publishing outlet. But, you know, in the book, I go back and tell some of the stories of the Rodale family and their struggles to achieve legitimacy. And just like many of the other prophets in the book, it was not easy.
We're speaking with Joe Dobra. He's been the head of marketing for many concerns, including Whole Foods Market and Balducci's. And he's written Natural Profits from Health Foods to Whole Foods. And we're going to take another break, and we'll come back and take more of your calls. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Joe Dobro, who has written Natural Profits from Health Foods to Whole Foods. And it's PROPHETS. And of course, we'll have a link to the book on our website and on our Facebook page. You talked about the one seminal moment, Joe, with Silent Spring, but tell us about the ALAR crisis and how that affected the growth of the natural food industry.
Yes, in 1989, so 25 years ago, we had this crisis breakout with ALAR, A-L-A-R.
It's always in the crosswords.
Right.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, we sort of look back on that in the natural foods movement as being an alarming moment, because what happened was this was a chemical agent. It was actually called dimenazide. ALAR was its trade name. And it had been used for 25 years at that point to, well, sort of like Don, the caller earlier, was talking about with apples. Dimenazide, ALAR, was used to help apples stay on the tree a little bit longer and to help them to define the points on the apples a little bit more. The problem was that it was a suspected carcinogen, and the EPA had collected evidence for many years to that effect. But still, it was a very effective chemical agent, and so it continued to be allowed. Well, in early 1989, the Natural Resources Defense Council comes out with a report. And the report states that as many as 6,000 school children may someday contract cancer and die because of their exposure to ALR through the apple juice and applesauce that they consumed in rather large quantities. And this was a shocking piece of news because it crossed over from those little old health food stores that you were talking about before, and like the Bread of Life stores that Julie and Richie Gerber had run in Fort Lauderdale and elsewhere, crossed away from the Bread of Life's into the mainstream supermarkets. And all of a sudden, school districts began dumping their applesauce and canceling their contracts for apple juice. And this led to a 60 Minutes piece on February 26th of 1989. And then just a couple of weeks after that, to a Newsweek article with the infamous headline, Panic for Organic. So that too was a seminal moment because it galvanized people into action. It wasn't just the hippie fringe who was worried about this anymore. It was moms and dads and people driving wood paneled station wagons, because they now saw the report out there and they were scared.
And so is that when the stores started actually becoming competitive with one another? Because it seems like before that they had this common ethos and these ideals and kind of back to the earth spirit where they were more on each other's side.
Yes, I would say that those events were contemporaneous, but not necessarily a cause and effect there. I think the ALR crisis served more to bring organic foods into the conventional supermarkets where they had never had a home before. But you're absolutely correct that at the same time, you had these natural food stores that had been growing up all around the country. You had Bread and Circus in Boston and Mrs. Gooch's in Los Angeles and Nature's Fresh Northwest in Seattle and Bread of Life in Florida. And all of these stores had been growing pretty rapidly. And as you said, they had been, this spirit of communal sharing had always permeated the industry. So they would meet periodically, they'd share P&Ls and HR information, and you don't see that sort of thing happening in industries today. But it was around this time, once the natural and organic foods industry really did start to take off, and those PROPHETS turned to PROFITS, that spirit began to disintegrate a little bit. Whole Foods went on a big buying binge at that point, and they bought all of the aforementioned companies. They bought Bread and Circus, they bought Mrs. Gooch's, they bought eventually Bread of Life.
Wild Oats too?
They did. That was a little bit later still.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But yeah, they really became the behemoth in the industry, and it was part of the genius of the people who were running it, that they finally saw this vision that this could become a natural, national, coast-to-coast company. And today, Whole Foods is number 232 on the Fortune 500 list. So they've come a long way in a short time.
Joe, in the book, you talk about management science and you use the term disruptive innovation. Could you define that for us?
Every once in a while, a technology comes along that is disruptive. And instead of allowing growth to continue on a steady curve, it creates a discontinuity. And so we jump from point A to point G all at once. And that is exactly what I see happened in the natural foods industry. Had we just continued on that slow, steady growth pace, you wouldn't see Whole Foods with 370 stores. You wouldn't see Publix having launched their Greenwise markets, either the stores or the private label products. We probably would be two decades behind where we are right now. But we did experience this sort of disruptive effect because of the confluence of all of these events we've been talking about. And it was really in this very short time period from, let's say, 1989 with the Alar crisis to 1992 when Whole Foods went public, and that sort of broke through and gave natural foods companies access to Wall Street money that they'd never had before. And then right after that, you had this fascinating three-way battle for supremacy begin to emerge between Whole Foods and Wild Oats and Freshfields, each of which had aspirations to become the big kahuna. And I tell that story in quite a bit of detail in the book. But all that happened between 1989 and 1996, and that was that period of disruption where the industry went from point A to point G.
Well, there's so many more questions and more calls.
We'll have plenty of links on our website and also the Topical Currents Facebook page.
Joe Dobrow, he's a trained historian, which I want to ask you about, but he's been the head of marketing for Freshfields, Whole Foods Market, among others. And his book is entitled Natural Profits, From Health Foods to Whole Foods, How the Pioneers of the Industry Changed the Way We Eat and Reshaped American Business. Thank you so much for joining us today. And as Joe said, we will have links to the book on Facebook page and our website.
Well, thank you both. It's really been a pleasure. And you clearly read lots of books, so I appreciate that because your level of knowledge is terrific.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
And apologies to Art, Lewis, Hans. We couldn't get to your calls. We do thank you for tuning in. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. Tomorrow's program begins with the Miami Marlins. No, not the big league version, but the colorful AAA Marlins of the 1950s. Satchel Paige, Pepper Martin, Bill Veeck. Also, Linda Gassenheimer celebrates National Paella Month. I hope it's there for tasting. We do have free audio archives and program downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information at the Topical Currents Facebook page. And the calendar. On this day in 1911, 103 years ago, the birth of playwright Tennessee Williams in Columbus, Mississippi. The nickname Tennessee came from his southern drawl while attending the University of Missouri. A Streetcar Named Desire, A Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Glass Menagerie, The Night of the Iguana, The Rose Tattoo. And on this day in 1930, 84 years ago, the birth of writer Gregory Corso in New York. He was the youngest of the Beats. And one more while we read about his opposition to the Second Boer War and liberal reform. On this day in 1945, 69 years ago, the death of David Lloyd George, the only British Prime Minister who spoke English as his second language. He was Welsh. So we leave with a thought from David Lloyd George, Prime Minister during the last 2 years of World War I. Quote, "A politician is a person whose politics you don't agree. If you agree with him, then he's a statesman." Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.